ourselves. When we study a problem, we tend to rethink it in terms that we've already used. And if we do so, we fall into a routine analysis. And we can think that we understand the subject very well, and we will hear ourselves reciting in our minds what we consider to be the correct solution of the problem. And yet, we are still in a groove. The analysis proceeds in a cycle, and we never get out of it, and never find alternative action schemes that would help in the situation. So I'm going to draw a closed beam. This line represents a force which has rotated and closed an area. In the act of closing this area, it has trapped a certain amount of force inside and excluded force beyond it. The excluded force is infinitely extended, but the included force is finite. When we take a force from outside and allow it to impinge on this closed force, then a stimulus occurs at the point of impact and a reverberation is set up inside. Now, simply because of this rotating band, which is keeping this finite in being, any stimulus energy coming in is forced by the nature of the circumscribing line to assume a similar form. That is, it will start rotating. The forces inside here are rotating, so that any stimulus that comes into this finite being will actually start to rotate. If we let this circumscribing line represent the boundary of an egg, or the boundary of a human being, which is simply an egg parted into many little eggs or cells, then every incoming stimulus energy, sooner or later, usually very soon, begins to rotate. Now, every rotation set up and characterized becomes a subsidiary entity inside the main one under consideration. This means that for every incoming energy characterized in a certain way, we'll say X, there must be a rotating force set up characterized in the same way. If there is another stimulus characterized as Y, then very shortly there is a Y sub N. Now, these sub-ends are characterized formally and emotively, or effectively. The form of the stimulus coming in is that whereby we recognize it visually, how the motion affects the organ of vision, produces a form or a shape. But also, according to the amount of energy, its rate of entry, its mode of vibration, the receiving being can receive it either totally or not. If it can totally absorb it and there's no extra energy over, then the fact that the receiving being has absorbed it is interpreted psychologically by that being as pleasure. It has gained the energy. But if the incoming energy is too strong or lasts too long, so that the receiving being becomes saturated with it, and yet more is coming, and it cannot assimilate the more, and then the whole being is literally pushed away by the incoming energy, which it cannot assimilate. And in the act of being pushed away, it feels a negative psychological state. It doesn't like it. It calls it painful. Remember, pain is the place of refusal. The aim in pain means refusal, means unwoke. It's also a word, spelled slightly different, design, a plural of I, which again tells you that it's a sub-end. Every pain experienced in our tissue is the product of too much energy coming in. And being unassimilable, we try to defend ourselves against it by running away. If we can't run away indefinitely, and in a closed social situation we can't, then we try to wall off the painful energy inside ourselves. We try to box it up. In the case of emotional situations precipitated and objectified in the chest, in TB, we put a wall of calcium around the irritant part. We actually surround it because we don't like the sensation from that place. Now, every such isolated entity, walled off, is a center of pain. And it is very, very sensitive to any stimulus with any character whatever, similar in any respect to the initiating stimulus that gave it the first pain. So if we take, let's take the word pain again. If we take a situation in which the word pain is engrammed on the child's mind, you take the child and experimentally you slap it with a butter paddle or something, and you utter the word pain. The word pain goes in the ear, and the butter paddler goes on the arm and sends a message that the stimulus came in too quickly, we can't assimilate it, we don't like it, and simultaneously the word pain is heard. Now, if we then recite the word pain to a child that's been so treated, that actually arises from the place which was struck in the child, from the very cells which experienced that first pain, a mnemic reaction. Out of the substance springs up, the word pain appeared with that slap. And so when the word pain occurs in the whole sensorium, it stimulates everything that was present at the time. Now, because we have four letters here, we have immediately a complex method of relating this pain situation to other things. Supposing you have a girlfriend named Anne, that's A-N. That's already two elements here. We spell Anne down here. We've got, in this word, two stimuli that can stimulate N in that word, and one that can stimulate A. So the next time that little girl who's been slapped goes out to play with her friend Anne, for some reason she doesn't like Anne quite so much as she did before. She doesn't know why, but in fact it's caused by the litter stimulus values which have acted on her and unconsciously re-stimulated the pain engram from the butter paddle. So she now has what would be called an irrational dislike of Anne, and that day she doesn't play with her. And this is the cause in children of them playing and not playing with each other on alternate days or in alternate minutes. The characterizing stimulus comes and determines that activity. And it will continue to determine it until they understand it, which means for a long time. We can see here that if we take the word ape, we have already a new stimulus which has two points, A and P, in it. If we like to spell an, A-N-N-E, we have another point of relation between the word ape and an, so A and E. Now all these things begin to cross. Then the word ape, through the medium of A and E, can stimulate N. Now, this kind of thing looks very mechanical, it is very mechanical, but it is actually nearly 100% of the cause of troubles in people's relations. When we think in terms of words, we are using special signs which have stimulus value, and they resonate through your whole being. So that every word with A in it is linked together. Every word with B in it is linked together, and so on. This means that your whole vocabulary is linked together, and the numbers of letters most often repeated have the greatest stimulus value and the greatest power to change moods. If we take the fact that in the English language the letter E occurs most, you would expect the letter E to have the greatest valency, the greatest power to produce mood changes. In fact, if you test people very carefully with this, you will find emotive biases towards and away from specific letters. Thus you'll find that letter N, when you say it, closes the nose partially. If you do it, if you've all got the front of it to do it now, and you say, you feel immediately that the whole organism is saying no. It is closing its nose. It is refusing. There's a bad smell about the place. You're living in the northeast, and the wind is blowing from the southwest. And so you say, no, I don't like it. So that when you hear this sound, n, which is actually a closure of the nose, there's a sensation of disliking someone. You can watch this in somebody if you discuss a certain difficult point of subject with them, and you know that they don't like certain factors, and you deliberately frame a question to which they must reply yes, such as, do 2 and 2 make 4? You would say yes, because he's afraid of the conclusion you're going to draw from it. He knows you're up to mischief, so he cannot say yes, which would be an unqualified affirmation, because he thinks you've got a card on your sleeve. And if he says yes, you're going to wheel out something horrible that he doesn't want. So he says yes. He knows the Russians are very fond of this noise.
A number of these will, of course, cancel each other out, won't they? For example, the word nice and pain will produce a start of research for them, you see.
Well, that's
something else.
Yes, they might, but they can't cancel each other out exactly, no, because of the law of inequality of finance. And even the word nice has become nearly meaningless because of this fact. You see, it's the same as the word net in German, which also means nice. It means precise. But the volitional side of our nature hates it. It hates niceness. It hates precision. It hates formal behavior. It hates any social pressure. And so, if somebody says, what do you think about notes? Rather nice. And it's net. You see? It's net. It's really not worth bothering. It's a little finicky thing, a nice thing. The word good, which comes out of the good department, is much stronger. So if you said it was good, meant it, you'd be giving it an unqualified affirmation. But if you say it's only nice, then you've already weakened your approval. Now, the very important thing to realize is this. When energy comes to you at a rate faster than you can assimilate, then it is felt psychologically as painful, and the pain is not liked. And therefore, it is walled off by another energy which tries to stop it spreading. Now, the only consciousness that helps us to keep balanced is total consciousness. Total awareness. And when a pain results from excess stimulation, the walling up to try to stop it spreading results in a drop in the level of consciousness. In other words, as soon as the pain comes, you are no longer totally conscious. The pain has the power to cut down on your total consciousness. It excludes this thing that annoys you. Now, Christianity is about this. It says that because of pain can cut down on your wholeness by making you refuse something, if you wish to retain wholeness, you must affirm the painful situation. If you dodge the painful situation, you have then got inside you a sub-end, a mnemic complex of forces, which you will never allow to come again into consciousness. And yet it refers to factual information outside. So you have actually put yourself out of proper functional relation with the environment. But if you can accept that even though it was refused because it was excessive, by a new attitude, a new orientation, by a deliberate expanse of yourself, in other words, a relaxation, less egotism, by expanding in this way, cutting the egotistic self-definition, and expanding one's being, one can increase the amount of space inside and then move towards that which was a moment before painful. You've altered your concept of things. You have expanded your definition of your being, and now you have actually more data because you've included more data with your expanded concept. You can now advance towards this painful stimulus. And you then find you can assimilate that which a few seconds ago you couldn't assimilate because you had a concept that it was painful and that pain is to be rejected. As soon as you can get this universally valid truth firmly fixed in your substance, then you can start expanding your concept of yourself, give yourself the highest possible concept, namely that ultimately it would be better if every individual could assimilate all kinds of stimulation. If a being can make himself able to absorb every stimulus there is, every possible stimulus, then he automatically becomes immortal. Immortality and the capacity for absorbing stimuli is just two different terms for one thing. In the same way that mortality is the same as incapacity for absorbing certain energies. What you can't absorb and assimilate, if it comes to you and keeps coming, will push you away, jam you in a corner somewhere in a finite situation, and then proceed to cut you to bits. So the pursuit of control, which means with law bindings, the pursuit of immortality, which means unbreakability, the pursuit of heightened consciousness, is all tied up with the advance on a point of pain. When a stimulus comes to a man, I'll take a particular situation, and the stimulus is such that the man doesn't like it, and the stimulus has come from another being, we call the two beings B. By B we mean the stay-at-home man, and by A we mean the active energies. This incidentally is a reverse of Gurdjieff's use of the term, but this is phonetically accurate, and his was arbitrary for the purpose of writing a book. The alpha, the olive, the A, is prior to the B, and therefore refers to the absolute, which is an infinite energy. B is the limiting factor, circumscription, pronounced with the lips closed and folded, and therefore a B being is a finite, whereas A truly is a non-being, but is a force. Now there's an infinite A, but only a finite B. Now let a certain gentleman be represented by B. He has a finite concept of himself and his duties, and another being is identified with aspirations, with rising to ever higher and higher virtues, with improving the situation, with introducing more energy into the situation. Now, B has a certain rate of assimilation. He can't take more than he can take with the available assimilation concepts he's got. Now, we'll assume for the moment that the being identified with the transcendent force A is a finite being, and therefore a B, but is a B with the concept of A in him. He says it's worth gaining transcendence. And then he makes another one. It's worth giving it to other people, too. So the concept inside himself is that A, the absolute, is worth getting. It's infinite, which is more powerful than the finite. It is omniscient, which knows more than the partial science. And it would be a good idea if everybody were to be made to know this as quickly as possible. Now it's all very nice, except it isn't defined what as quickly as possible means. So this being, who is circumscribed, and has the concept of A, the transcendent, absolute, now proceeds to inform B, down here, who hasn't got the concept of the absolute transcendence. And he sends this stimulus to him. Now, every being, if it could possibly become omnipotent in one leap, would do so. And if it finds that another being has had a jump at it before itself, it tends to be upset. So when this being with the two A's in its B, we call it Ba, talks to this little form of the B and reminds him of transcendent force, he's really jumped this other B to the goal. He's really said, I perceived it before you did. So he then, in fact, points out that the B to whom he sent the message is an inferior B. And the B who now receives this message must feel that he's been got at, that it's had it pointed out to him that he's an inferior B because he didn't think of it first and he didn't move toward it. If he could have spotted the absolute first, and thrown it to the barman, he would have done so. But his energy level and formal conditionings and genetic factors didn't allow him to do it. So, in fact, he's the recipient of a stimulus that said there is an absolute, a goal worth attaining, a transcendent energy that is now being introduced. He must then hit back in every way that his formal equipment allows him to, against the source of the stimulus. This transcendent energy cannot be assimilated by him in his condition. And a special extra is, he doesn't want to assimilate it because he didn't discover it first. Because it's very important to be first, you know, in discovering anything, as far as the ego center is concerned, because of self-value. Now, a reaction must occur between Ba and B. But the order of the reaction will be determined by the man who knows most about it. If this Ba being can increase his awareness of all the factors inside himself and gain total response, which will give him the correct reply, not a correct reply, the correct reply for the total situation, then whatever stimulus B shoots at Ba must be easily assimilable by Ba, and therefore Ba can handle it. But B, who cannot send the force of the stimulus faster than Ba can assimilate it, must feel further inferior. Now, if he's made to feel sufficiently inferior by the superior absorption power of Ba in the situation, he will superfeast. But if he detects any way whereby, through an error of Ba, he could invert the situation, then he must, by formal conditioning, try to do it. Everything inside an individual man is exactly the same as it is outside the man. So this circle can represent the whole universe, or an individual man, or a cell within man. Supposing we take a particular cell, that cell has been the recipient of a stimulus of the order P. It then recites P. But that cell is in contingent relation with other cells. Supposing each one of these other cells receives a stimulus, here A, there I, there N. Now, if we take the cell characterized by P, it has been stimulated by N, by A, and by I. So that cell has P, A, I, N in it. But the A cell is being stimulated by I, N, and P. And same with the I cell is being stimulated by A, P, and N. Each cell in the body has all stimulus records of all the cells, the difference between them being only a matter of the dominant. The strongest stimulus, the one that got in first, at the highest intensity, and modified the tissue of that cell, so that all incoming stimuli are then characterized, and that stands as the fundamental, and all subsequent ones will stand as harmonics upon that fundamental. And just as we've seen in the literal significances, which can operate visually or audially, simply by speaking the words, so, in fact, in the cell relation in the body, a resonance occurs from every cell to every other cell. So that once a fundamental has been set in any given cell, then all the harmonic relations, that is, the subdivisions of the concept inserted in the stimulus, will cause it to be in relation with other cells in the body. Now, every cell is receiving energy either fast enough to assimilate or too fast to assimilate. If it's too fast, it will be painful. If it can be assimilated, it will be a certain amount of pleasure. If it's assimilable, but a lot more could come into it than is coming, there will arise what is called a feeling of wanting more, a sensation of lack of this stimulus. And the organism will start moving towards the stimulus source in order to increase the rate of income. We can then say that the individual egg, and this is in flat contradiction to most biological science today, the individual egg is not an aggregate of cells. But the individual egg is itself the prior unity which determines the behavior of the individual selves in collaboration with the incoming stimulus. So if we take this as an egg or a man or a universe, then there are certain forces in it, we will call genetic forces, coming out of the creative center into the action band, and there are forces from outside it impinging on its perimeter, and the genetic forces and the external forces of stimulation are actually engaged in a combat in the action zone as to which will determine the behavior of the organism. And the more we can become aware of the immanent spirit in the center, the more whole we can become, the more we can realize the necessity for a whole awareness, the more we can learn to control our reaction to the incoming stimulus. And by a progressive expansion of our concept of individual being, we can extend our dominion conceptually. And this doesn't mean merely abstractly, because as soon as we extend our concept of our range of action, we also extend the field response of our organism. The organism begins to vibrate through the field, and instead of being finite to the gross material derived from external food, it becomes progressively more and more responsive to the field. Now the field is actually infinite. So our response becomes infinite when we identify with infinity. But if we identify with any particular conceptual level, like the vegetable level or the animal level or the man level, now, the very act of identifying with that given concept, we finite our receptive power. And at the same time, we introduce into ourselves the possibility of pain. Because pain is the product of a finite being receiving more energy than can assimilate. So we have a weapon in our own hands for dealing with situations, namely a conceptual weapon, because we can conceive ourselves in any way we want. But if we conceive ourselves formally, we will impose on ourselves, we will get the fruits of our own attitudes. If a man who belongs to the Labour Party is what is called a sincere Labour man, and somebody comes along and tries to bribe him into the Conservative Party because he's got the gift of the gab, if he's a sincere man, he will feel insulted. Insulted means that some energies have injunct, insult is injunct. There's something there that as a pure Labour man he didn't want to assimilate, and that was a conservative concept of government. This man comes to him, and with his conservative concept he injuncts, insults into that man. That man immediately feels what he calls insulted or jumped into, and he doesn't like it because his concept of himself as a Labour man cannot logically assimilate the conservative concept. Now, what we do find is that most men are not what we call sincere Labour men. When they've worked for a certain length of time and they've risen in the trade union scale, and a certain conservative gentleman says, I will make you foreign minister if you will extend your theory of labour a little bit to include conservative procedure, then in general his movement to expand, which is more important than his political belief, expands his concept, and the energy can then come in and be assimilated. Now this is bound by the concept to go on, because in such a field and throughout the range of human activities generally, there is always a movement to transcendence. That is, everybody would like to be bigger and better. In the words of Samuel Butler, they'd like to be exactly 3 inches bigger than everybody else. There's nothing against the infinite extension of all individuals, providing they do it on the level where it's possible, and that is on the spiritual level. There's nothing at all against every man being 3 inches bigger than every other man at the spiritual level, because the spirit is infinite, you can do it. But if you try to be 3 inches bigger than every other man at the physical level, you'll find certain logical and material inconsistencies. Now, mutual interpenetration of all spiritual forms is a fact of the dynamics of the absolute. All motions in infinity pass infinitely into all other zones of infinity. Any point in infinity is a center and is a being. Any zone round the point is an environment for that point. And any motion initiated in one point in infinity travels infinitely into all other points. So there's actually a mutual co-presence of all forces in all places in infinity. And it is because of this that everybody feels somehow that they should be able to expand to infinity. Because actually at the top level they already are so expanding. But when they try to unmaterialistic viewpoints to extend this growth at the gross material level, then it becomes apparent that there's a different law working at the gross material level from that at the level of the infinite. All great religion teaches the same truth. When it is realized that the infinite is the only thing worth having, then the man who realizes it stops striving for the finite. And these rather cunning psychologists like Abraham, you remember, sacrificed, was prepared to raise the knife, sacrifice Isaac, and it was accounted to him as a mark of faith. And if he happened to be somewhat Hebraic, we can say it was also good counting. We did an analysis about this before. We pointed out that when Abraham was about to stick the knife into Isaac, he had thought, Jewish style, and said, either the divinity whose voice I heard is a real divinity or not. If it's not, then the promise to my seed will not be fulfilled in any case. And if he is real, and his promise can be fulfilled, if I refuse to stick in the knife, he'll get vexed with me and change his mind. So if I go to stick in the knife, while he's testing me, I'm testing him. I go to stick in the knife, if he doesn't stop me, and he is this God, he's bound to give me another seed. Whereas if he's not this God, he can't give me another seed, and he can't fulfill the promise in any case. So I might as well go back to work. Now, this kind of what we might call, in its full sense, Yiddish analysis, is going on all the time inside every being. In other words, every being has inside it a member of the chosen people. It's true that there's a special stress in the gross material world called chosen people, but also inside any single individual on earth, there is the same frequency that the gross material chosen people think they have originated at the gross level. And that same frequency always was inside every being in infinity. It just happens that one particular decided to stress it, and some others decided to stress something else. When they stress something else, like the Hamitic or Yephitic stress, then the Shemitic one lapsed from consciousness. But it is inside everyone. It is very important to see this because of the doctrine of the election of grace. The Calvinists, if they follow themselves very carefully, will have to see that the election of grace, the predestination of some beings to be saved, doesn't refer to particular finite gross beings, but it refers to certain concepts which are inside every being. And these concepts are the concepts of the election, which any being can stress in himself and in so doing become elect. So then the election is a self-election. But the self which is electing that self is none different from the absolute, because it is the absolute acting in that zone. I will just go back a little bit and recap here. Every finite being presented with a stimulus is being presented with a characterized energy. This energy, by means of its character, is going to orientate the being in a given formal manner. The being will tend to move in one way rather than another because of the character of the incoming stimulus. When the being has been subject to a lot of stimuli of various orders of form, then the being, through its internal relations of these forms, becomes immensely complex. You remember the fellow who was told after he invented the game of chess that he could have any reward he wanted, and he said to the king, well, I will have one piece of corn on the first square, and two pieces on the second, four pieces on the third, eight pieces on the fourth, and just keep doubling up and I'll be satisfied. So the king, who wasn't good at mental arithmetic, agreed to pay him. But when he came to reckon up how much corn was needed to keep doubling up, he hadn't got that much corn in the country. And that showed the superiority of the mathematical process in the mind of the man that devised this price. If, in effect, we look at a situation in which we are doubling up the stimuli inside a beam on a chessboard that are 64 squares, symbolic, 8 times 8, 8 of the white, 8 of the black, running through together, an eternity of consciousness, an eternity of substance together, and the white and black pieces are really dark wills and conscious awarenesses being played about on the board. Now you can play an awful lot of chess games for a long time without repeating your game, but it is finite, but it's such a large number that no people have repeated the chess game exactly so far. This could be because some of them are falling into a groove. There is a very large number. Now, just as a little 64 square chessboard can have such a large number of ways of playing the game, so we can see that a human being with millions and millions of cells inside it, each cell like a little square, but unlike the square on a chessboard, not simple, because inside each cell there is a complete formal packet of hereditaments, so that every cell in the body with a nucleus has a complete record of the whole of its ancestral experience. And there are millions and millions of these in the body, and they're all busy sending their messages all the time through each other. Now, if there were no external stimulus situations, and all these cells were to send their messages, they would all cancel out and there would be a perfect equilibrium. And nothing would happen particularly because they'd all refute each other. And if there were no immanent spirit to disturb it from inside, then it would just carry on in that state of perfect equilibrium, which is the pralaya or rational layer, the balancing, the levelling of all forms. That would be perfectly static. But factually, there is immanent spirit, and there is transcendent spirit. The transcendent spirit attacks it from outside immediately, and also by bringing together other beings called Ba and making them shoot concepts of transcendence with another being called B. So the external stimulus situation and the activity of the immanent spirit sending them out causes a continuous disequilibrium. So that as the cells are all shouting out their own messages as loud as they can, some of them are reinforced by external stimuli, and some of them are reinforced by the action of immanent spirit. So there's a continuous, perpetual, highly complex flux of formal play inside the organism. And for every formal presentation, there is a corresponding emotive, affective process. That is to say, there is a mood for every form. So if you look inside yourself, you will actually find yourself varying from moment to moment in your orientation to any given idea. If you think you shouldn't, you become disgusted with yourself and you say, I'm just unreliable. If you say you're unreliable, you will impose on yourself a super stress on the concept of unreliability. This will then receive extra special energy and it will keep broadcasting to all the cells you're unreliable. And when it does so, you will become progressively more and more unreliable. Now, whatever concept you select inside yourself for recitation, plus energizing by belief, which is beloved, you like it, and then you energize it with your love, that concept will broadcast, and by resonance, it will dominate all the messages from the other cells. It will become a superstress, and it will then condition the whole behavior of that system in a specific direction. When it does so, then the whole destiny of that being is actually under the dominion of that little concept. Now it takes a long time with such a concept going about in a continuing relation before the headache resulting from the collision caused by this concept to sink in and modify the concept. But it doesn't take a long time to realize the absolute truth of this elementary fact. There is a finite being, an external stimulus situation and an internal stimulating energy. That between the internal and the external, there is a contested zone. That this contested zone is characterized formally by the stimulus and effectively by its own psychic mode of receiving it. So the whole mass of the being is full of pleasures and pains at the psychic level, of formal presentations at the rational level, and strange, unaccountable urges which are simply the actual movements of the involved energies. Once we realize this, we can see immediately that there are no problems, not the most subtle and most intimate and high-flung erotic ramifications of romantic wantedness, nor one and two makes three. Not anything whatever lies uncoverable by this fact, that there is an external stimulus, an internal force to meet it, and a contested zone between them. If you know that, you will not look for any romantic explanations of your most poetic moods. You won't look for the woman of your choice other than the one you've got, because really it's an embodiment of work. You won't even look for the man of your choice that you couldn't possibly find, because there isn't one. What you will do is realize this fact and become progressively more heightened in awareness of what forces are acting upon you at a given moment, and how much of immanent spirit, that's pure initiative, you are able to bring into the action zone to balance the external stimulus situation. When you do so, you must automatically begin to feel more and more in control of the situation, more and more moving in the direction that you know you should move in. Now, every being knows, from a newborn baby upwards, that he should, should implies power, use the energy he's got in order to fulfill himself. To do it, he must learn to control himself. He must learn to understand himself in order to control himself. So every being is equipped with this desire to become more fully himself, to get more life, as Christ said, to have life, to have it more abundantly, because every being can propagate infinite. And therefore, every being knows that it is quite right for it to get it, if it can, to get infinite life, eternal life. It can get it only while it exists, and that is at infinity. Exists is, of course, the wrong word. It can get it at infinity. It cannot get it at the gross material level, because that is not the level at which it operates. So it then shifts the whole of the accent into infinity. But it knows that in the actual shifting of it, it hasn't destroyed the value of time, because the time process can be utilized for a mode of analysis of the incoming stimulus and the immanent spirit's initiating forces to deal with. So then the time, that is the rotation band, is seen to be inside the eternity, hey Trinity, infinite spirit, is seen to be the absolute value, worthy of attainment. The time process is always seen to be a means whereby one becomes progressively more and more aware of the eternal fact. Then one stops the fight between the time and the eternity and starts looking at the time as an opportunity, a sort of gift, a datum. A datum is something given. It's an opportunity given so that this awareness can actually be made aware of its eternity and use the time as an opposing concept to the eternity to make the eternity stand more clearly in the mind. Because if we scrub out the time and leave only the infinite eternal, we have nothing to judge it against. And if we don't judge the eternity against the time, eternity is valueless. And if we want to get the value out of eternity, out of infinity, out of omniscience, out of omnipotence, then we need the finite, the impotent, the ignorant, in order to evaluate the opposite. So then we try this dialectical trick of the sages, the Taoists, the Christian, whatever religion he is, providing he's not belonging to one order of religion is called gross materialist. he must pursue the infinite, and he must pursue it in infinite ways. And he does it by simply affirming all the things that most men don't. He must pursue ignorance. Instead of trying to find knowledge, supposing a sage said, well, according to rule, the pursuit of knowledge produces strife amongst individuals. So I'm not going to pursue that. I must pursue its opposite. I must try daily to become more ignorant. But I must know what I'm doing, because I must be conscious if I'm going to be a sage. Because sage is sargate, spirit, actively entering the gross material situation, embodying itself, objectifying itself. So he said, I'm going to try and be the most ignorant man in the world. And in order to do so, I must know what ignorance is. So I must be able to define ignorance so accurately that I don't accidentally start gaining knowledge in mistake for ignorance. So he has to begin by defining ignorance properly. As soon as he knows what ignorance is, then unfortunately he's immediately wise. And this is the dialectical nature of evolution. Whatever you go for, you will get the opposite if you try to get one horn of the dilemma. If you try to get one end of the stick and cut the other off, there'll always be another one there. So if we actively try to become more ignorant daily, but we try to do this consciously, knowing what ignorance is, we can't help becoming wiser. But if we try to get to know more and more every day, we must become a specialist. And a specialist knows every day more and more about less and less, until finally he becomes an expert on the absolute motions of an isolated entity, which immediately places him out of relation completely with what is going on in the universe, and therefore opens a doorway to the most magnificent heavens. Because you can go for a pain in the toe to a nose, ear and throat man, and he will spray the back of your pharynx for it, because that's his department. If we look at ignorance and try to become it, we have to work very hard.
It will pull down.
Don't let's pull down, it's too easy. It's much more difficult to read this way. The point I, the letter I is a point, and the hard G means the earth, gross matter compacted. Ig means a point of gross earth. So if you want to be the first part of ignorance, namely Ig, you must concentrate on the gross material world. If you don't concentrate on this gross material fact first, you can't be ignorant properly, because that's the first step. You can see why empirical materialistic scientists are profoundly ignorant, because they concentrate very hard on the gross material fact. But that's only a part of it, you see, they don't always do the rest of it. Now, when you concentrate on the gross material fact, you must then say no. You must say, the mere fact that I can concentrate on this thing means that I have excluded all the other things that I'm not looking at the moment. So I must say no to it. Because already I know something about this in the act of concentrating upon it. If I concentrate on this chalk and test it with my five senses, unfortunately I start learning things about it. So I must say no to it. I must scrub it out. But when I scrub it out, if I don't fall asleep, and I keep awake when I scrub it out, I differentiate all the energies that were packed into that gross matter. And that's the letter R. Now this ants at the end is like a short form of essence, except it means an energy moving and producing an issue. The essence is a moving energy, continuously issuing forth and behaving in this manner. So ignorance implies that we have taken the essence, differentiated, negated, of a gross material fact. If we do this, we can't help knowing more and more about it. But in the process, we are becoming aware that any finite situation, an ik, necessarily cuts down on our capacity for dealing in relation with beings. The pursuit of the gross material scientist or ultimate truth has resulted in the penetration of the atom, which was misnamed, because atom means uncuttable, and has produced the electron. The attempt to penetrate into the electron has produced perhaps one of Schrodinger's wave equations, which is a sort of compromise between a particle and a wave. It's like a wave of the hand without the hand there. Now, when you come down to this level, the very thing you were trying to stand on, a gross material practice, an absolute basis of surety, suddenly disappears in a wave and propagates to infinity. It departs. And suddenly then, he feels ignorant. Suddenly, at the other end, the mathematicians, who've never believed in this empirical method, come into their own. They have always said that there's something peculiar about the nature of zero, such that if we carry on analyzing zero, which is nothing, we should be able, by extending zero into unity and dividing the unity and so on, to precipitate a mathematical structure. And providing this mathematical structure is dynamic, that is to say, it is the numerical equivalent of a system of interrelated forces, it must then cover the whole of phenomena. Whether or not any particular at the moment is susceptible of analysis by a given individual, it must, by its inherent nature, be possible to cover the whole of phenomena in terms of the propagation of forces and their analysis in terms of geometry. Once we understand this fact, and we understand the use of the diagram of a circle, the fact that it encloses, encloses, and excludes, closes out, simultaneously, and in so doing, brings into being the external stimulus relation and the immanent spirit internal stimulus relation. Once we've understood that, we know that no matter how far we go, in whatever world we go, whatever the problem, it is susceptible of a dynamic analysis in these terms. And then we don't look any further. We examine every situation in this way. I think of my body as a recipient organism for external stimulation, and I feel inside it a moment of initiative, using the moment in the engineer sense, a turning moment where energy comes in and changes the situation from inside. I know that the external stimulus does not determine me completely, because I can alter my responses inside a closed situation where the external stimuli are constant. And if it were totally determined from without, I couldn't do that. So I know I've got an inner center of force, which I can use to send into my vehicle to meet the external incoming stimulus, and to condition it in the direction I want it to move. And I want it to move back to infinity, only because I'm in the finite. When I was in infinity, I wanted it to move towards the finite, because that's the act of creation. Having created, I want to move the other way. After doing this for a few ages, a few eons, then I say, well, I'll do both at once. I've done enough practice alternating. So now I'm going to affirm the finite and the infinite simultaneously. And then, as Jacob Bloom said, time and eternity will be the same to me. And when they're the same, then I have a super concept that enables me to deal with whatever presents itself, because I cut every stimulus situation in half and say some of it refers to time and some of it to eternity, and I find out which. And I then determine whether my purpose is a temporal one, a momentary one, or an eternal one, or whether in a given complex situation certain elements of it are for temporal application and certain for eternal. And in the temporal, whether they are immediately to be realized, like getting out of the way of an approaching bus, or shortly to be realized, like a working man getting paid at the end of the week or month, or long-term to be realized, like being polite to somebody you know, so that somebody you don't know will give you an apple in about 5 years' time. If I become aware of these things, then all the problems called spiritual, ethical, moral, social, and so on, resolve themselves simply into what is the most effective way of functioning within this infinite field of force, considering that every point with which we identify is traversed with motions from every other point. Now, have we got any little point that we might hear about this? Any specific thing that strikes most violently? Yes, it's that one. You've got one. You've got a smiling, radiant face. You must have a large one. Go on, make one. Bertrand's.
The question of the preconceived ideas that have been worked into you over a long period and the introduction of the new ideas, there's always going to be this reversion to the old idea until such time as you manage to overlay it with great energy, I would think.
Yes, well, you've just now done the very thing I said that we shouldn't do. You have begun the first stage of self-hypnosis. You have said there is always going to be this thing until such time as we can answer it. Now, whatever you engram on your tissue is going to function unless you engram something else to contradict it.
You're not committed to a crime against the Holy Ghost?
You've committed a crime against the Holy Ghost and against yourself, because the Holy Ghost is your imminent spirit functioning as outgoing messenger to you.
Well, how do I reduce the energy of the old concept?
Well, by not saying funny things that hypnotize you into thinking you can't. The first thing is to realize that wherever there is a point of refusal in yourself, what a psychologist would call a point of repression, wherever you've been hurt, physically, rationally, or emotionally, you have closed down on it. And in the act of closing down on it, you have finited your understanding. You have excluded certain data from consciousness. And therefore, it is your duty to discover your sore points. To go towards the very thing that you don't want to go towards, naturally, to find out the centres of pain in yourself, and look at them, and see whether the pains are really the legitimate functions of present stimulus situations, or whether they're merely mimic, belong in some past time, and therefore one need not carry on suffering with them.
But I have found just the same, although I am aware of higher concepts, under stress, the old mimic ideas have come out when I haven't wanted them to.
And that's merely because you haven't penetrated yet into the negative areas of yourself. This depends on how clear you become. You see, we give lip service to a thing because when a message first comes, you see, into a system which is already organized, when the stimulus energy comes in, the natural thing for all the energies inside here is to resist its entrance. So at first it's superficial, unrealized, insubstantial. If we repeat the stimulus often enough, it will gradually alter the formal contents of the actual zone. Then it will appear in the gross material world. Now you agree, in principle, that it's a good idea to examine the things of which you are afraid, the things that are painful to you, because they lack up energy and finite your understanding and hide things from you. And that's only the result of a little stimulus on the eardrum or somewhere. And not often enough has it been repeated. You have to drive yourself into painful situations. And specifically, emotional painful situations. Look for yourself inside and find out the things you don't want to find out. Simply because you don't want to know them. Because if you won't drive yourself to find out the things that you don't want to find out, you've got areas of resistance inside yourself that keep you cut up, keep you partially schizophrenic, and so they simply cut your mind into compartments.
Yes, I'm aware of that, but I don't like to think that I'm just paying lip service to the idea.
Well, as an example, you see, you don't like to think that. That's already a painful situation. Now, would you like to examine that one? Would you like now to examine that one?
Yes.
Is it sufficiently painful to make it worthwhile?
Quite willing to try it.
Yes. Actually, of course, it must be sufficiently painful because it raised your temperature and made your face several degrees deeper in tone when you said it. You said, I don't like to think, etc., etc. Now, which I were you referring to? Capital I, or the conceptual.
The one inside me which applies itself to this work, I think.
Is that the I, or am I?
I can only say I hope so.
And you hope so. Now, which eye is doing the hoping? Well, we can see immediately that it can't be top eye, because top eye doesn't need to hope. So it must be a conceptual eye that you've set up, and this conceptual eye is the one that you want to become. But it's only a conceptual eye, it isn't the eye, because it's hoping. If one is, one doesn't have to hope to be.
Well, I must admit to myself that there are certain aspects of things that I've had presented to me which are not functioning within my being.
Yes, well, we can see why. Suppose we say this is the eye that is hoping in.
Yes.
We know that it can't be the whole awareness, because it wouldn't help, it would simply be. So this means a certain concept inside yourself there has been stimulated by whatever means, and brought into heightened awareness. And this one is the model of this one. But it isn't this one yet, it's only a model, small scale. And it has to be re-stimulated like this until it dominates the whole field of itself, which isn't yet. But it can't do this unless it has power to penetrate the negative zones of the personality. That is the painful situation.
So at the moment I am working with a subsidiary eye of these concepts.
That's right, yes. You see, the real eye, the one that is infinite, the pure consciousness, doesn't hope. It just is. But when being identified with a much lower one, you become aware of the possibilities of attaining it. You can't understand what it is at first. So what you get is a concept of it, not it. And then this concept becomes your centre of reference.
And is that concept sufficient to work concepts into the flesh?
Oh yes, providing you keep re-stimulating it. Because by resonance it must ultimately become it.
And what happens to the particular eye that has taken the concepts on in the first place when the ultimate?
It's transcended. Because the particular one, according to this diagram, we'll say it was this one. So the particular one was stimulated from outside by something, and there was an immanent spirit response, because the immanent spirit's always moving to infinity. Some external, we'll call it a religious influence, if you like, stimulus, struck on this concept and said there is a higher level of being than this one. And the inner one pressed out and said the goal is infinity. And this one stimulated one, although small, has merely said there is a higher level. So it has a concept, there is a higher level. So it searches all through here. And the concept called a higher level I is stimulated immediately through that one. That then becomes the ideal, not the fact, the ideal figure of the eye you want to become. It is still only conceptual. Whereas the real one is absolutely transcendent of all concepts. Now, the mere fact that you are discussing and thinking about this now, and that you had enough energy in you to drive yourself, actually to expose yourself instead of folding up, in the presence of all your close friends who understand you and sympathize with you, whereas we'll say Greta to have a dig at her to raise the temperature, you see, didn't do it, although she could have done. But she didn't. Perhaps she's more polite. I'm sure she's more polite than I. Perhaps she's more polite than you. But when you did it, your temperature went up. The fact that it went up meant that you had released a bit of energy from inside yourself that had been hidden. That energy can be made yours if you dare to expose yourself.
I'm very susceptible to these energy flows. That means that I have a lot hidden.
That means you're growing. No, everyone's got a lot hidden. But if you become aware of them, you're lucky. Because as you become aware of them, they flood out. And you transcend them, and you can then go on to the next bogey level.
Well, can I ask something, Gina? I know this is true, but if I go away tomorrow night, I will say, well, let me have a look for some painful situation.
You mean you can't find that?
Yes, I can't do that. Having left this room, I've gone home, I've said, well, I'm going to try that now.
On yourself. You look inside yourself. You don't find it.
It isn't that sort of
thing. It's very difficult.
Yeah.
because they've already defined them as worn in, because they're painful. And frequently you have to creep up on them obliquely. That is, you have to use an association method to get at them. So what you do is deliberately ask yourself things. If I say to a small boy, what do you want to be when you grow up? Well, I don't know. But by the method of negation, we can begin to find out. I say, well, how would you like to be an income tax collector? And he may say, no, not for me. Would you like to be an Olympic runner? No. Now, by reciting a whole series of things, he becomes aware from inside that there are certain things he doesn't want. And this way, we're creeping up on the thing he does want. And in the same way, you can work inside yourself looking for painful situations by saying, well, what is not a painful situation to me? Now, the form of the stimulus you set yourself causes your total engrammed formal records to spring up again into awareness. But it is the form of the stimulus that does it. So if you say, well, I've got to face something painful, what is it? You know that all the painful things in your mnemic field are hiding. So you've got to creep up on them. So you say, well, what are the pleasant things? And you start thinking about those, but you have to keep an eye on yourself, otherwise you'll go on thinking about them all night. See, once you've got a good pleasurable one, you say, all right, what logically cuts across this pleasure? This way you can get at them. It's just a trick, a technical trick. All these little things inside, isolated and rotating, are sub-ends, and they're very sore, very painful, very tender, they can dodge. But you can get at them obliquely. This is what the word leaving means. Less handling trickery. You can't go directly to these things because they are walled against penetration because they're already overcharged with energy and pain.
Now,
so
must you go into the material situation?
You should begin, if you want to practice ignorance properly, with the material situation in which you find yourself. Then you should penetrate into the memories of previous gross material situations in which you have enjoyed yourself, and then you should try to think of the gross material fact that would stop that enjoyment, or did do, and feel inside yourself for points of annoyance, points of irritation, when you try to find out what it was that stopped that pleasure. Archimedes, of course, she came in at the wrong moment. As soon as you define the pleasure situation accurately, you'll be able to find something that cut across it, even if it was only the passage of time. Suddenly you had to run and lose your glass slipper or something. The fact is, something was against the continuance of that pleasure. So when you define the pleasure, you can begin to find that which cut across it. And when you do this consistently, you can find the painful thing. And as you watch inside, you will feel a tendency not to go in a certain direction, but to go in another direction. You always make yourself move through the memory field in the direction you don't want to go. Otherwise, you'll be sidetracked onto a pleasure memory again. But you can feel this ambivalence in yourself, a double will in yourself all the time. Pythagoras used the letter Y for dealing with it. A path and a fork. You can go to the right, to the left.
And remember the diagram we made?
Best piece of paper.
Thank you.
You see, now people tend either to respond volitionally or intellectually.
We say if they go this way, they're responding, we say this is the anti-clockwise way, they're responding by intellect. If they go that way, they respond by work.
Most people in a civilized state respond by some sort of rational process. They come to a moment of decision in their life, and they choose to go to the left, to use their heads, to try and reason it out. They come to another form. Again, they choose to go to the left, they come to another form. They choose to go to the left. They choose to go to the left. They choose to go to the left. They have created a cycle. This is the cause of the continuous repetition of stupid arguments in people's minds when they go to bed at night. Now, it isn't very many people, and certainly not for long, and they're called delinquents when they do, who choose this right-hand path of always being willful without thinking at all. There are a few, and they keep going back to jail. But the ideal is to see both of these things and do that.
And this bisection of the angle appears in the very Roman letter.